Coming up on Philosophy Talk, some decisions change your day, other decisions change your life.
You know what's tough about seeing people when they have a baby is that you have to match their level of enthusiasm.
Can transformative decisions be guided by reason?
Just once, I would like to meet a couple that goes, you know, we're not that happy with them, frankly. I think we really made a big mistake. We should have got an aquarium.
I know I've been changed. Ooh, I know I've been changed.
Can you make a decision with such profound consequences that you're really not going to be the same person who made the decision?
He's more machine now than man.
Our guest is Laurie Parr from UNC Chapel Hill.
Transformative experiences.
Autobots, transform and roll out.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Where we continue conversations that begin at Stanford University at Philosopher's Corner, where the philosophy department is, and Ken and I teach philosophy.
And today, we're philosophizing about experiences that transform us.
Some events in a person's life are so powerful, so life-altering, that there's a sense in which he or she may not be the same person afterwards.
Yeah, think of winning a mega lottery, for example. John, that would sure change my life, I know. I could buy more stuff, I would work less, I could travel
Ken,
more.
Ken, that's very superficial. That's all about external circumstances. We want to think about something that changes your basic values. The sorts of things that help to make you, you. I don't think money would change you that much, would it, Ken?
Well, you know, you're right. I'd like to think not, though. You know, you never really know. There are people who definitely can't handle sudden wealth. It turns them into completely different people, people their former selves wouldn't recognize or even approve of.
Well, I don't think you'd be like that. But for some people, not for you, winning a big lottery would be transformative. Too often in a negative way. But there are lots of positive transformational experiences, too, like having your first child or starting out in your chosen profession.
Yeah, I get you, John. What we're thinking about here by a transformative experience is one that somehow alters what matters to you. I think those are really kinds of important kinds of experiences to have. Growing up, I think, is just replete with transformative experiences.
That's not all. Think of what it's like to give birth to that first child.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's something I'm never going to know, John.
Well, all right. As a man, you can't possibly know what it's like to give birth because you're never going to give birth. But, you know, even a woman can't know what it's like to bear a child until she's given birth.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you there. No, that doesn't seem right. I mean, people are capable of learning lots of things from other people, thank God, without having to directly experience them for themselves. I mean, you want to know what it's like to give birth? Talk to a woman who's been there and done that. Read a good book. Go to parenting classes. I mean, you could watch a video of the action close-up of a baby being born.
I'll pass on that. I'm sure that's all good stuff and it helps, but it only gets you so far. It's no substitute for your own firsthand experience. It'll tell you something about what it was like for those people to have the experiences, but it won't tell you what it's going to be like for you.
But no, I don't think that's right, because if I know that I'm similar to them in relevant ways, won't knowing what it's like for them tell me an awful lot about what it would be like for me?
Well, but how do you know you're relevantly similar to them until you have actually had the experience for yourself and seen what happened and compared?
Now you seem to be saying that only experience can actually teach me what it's really like to be me, because I don't know which of these people I'm like until I have the experience?
Well, yeah, I think that's what I'm saying. I mean, certain experiences transform you epistemically. They change what you know, what you can know about yourself. They give you new insights into yourself that you couldn't get if you didn't have those experiences.
No, but now you seem to be suggesting that when a person actually decides to undergo one of these transformative experiences, then they're kind of taking a complete leap in the dark.
Well, yes, doubly so. First, they're in the dark because they don't know what the experiences they're going to have will be like. You don't know what your experience will be like if you go ahead and have it. Second, you're in the dark because you have no idea how your values might change in the light of having those experiences.
But wait a minute. How could, if that's all right, John, how could anyone ever decide, I mean rationally decide, to actually undergo one of these doubly transformative experiences of yours? Look, when we make decisions rationally, we try to decide partly on the basis of what we believe will happen once we make the decision, but you're saying we don't know what will happen, and partly on the basis of how we value the expected outcomes, but you're saying we don't know how to value them. But then if that's right, you can't possibly decide rationally in the case of these transformative experiences.
Aha! A rare occasion, Ken, I've convinced you of something. Namely, that experiences that transform us are worth philosophizing about. Especially because people do, in fact, choose to undergo transformative experiences every day. People enlist in the military. They have children. They choose a profession. They change their nationality. We'd like to think that most of the time their choices are rational, or could be rational. They're not necessarily insane and wacko. But it's unclear what makes such choices truly rational.
Yeah, jeepers, but you know, they can't be a matter of mere whimsy or fancy or guesswork. I don't think that could be right.
I'm not saying they are. I'm just saying that it's really puzzling not only how we do go about making these choices, but also how we should go about making them.
God, you know what, John? I'm going to admit something. For once, I'm stumped. I haven't a clue how we're going to solve this puzzle.
Well, I know how we're going to start. We're going to take a closer look at people confronting a potentially transformative choice in their lives and see what they do. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantare, to look at how people navigate one of life's most momentous choices. She files this report.
I recently took the plunge and had a baby. His name is Sina, and he's 5 months old. That's him. I'm happy, but my life has completely transformed in ways I could never have imagined. I feel like my brain has been rewired. My thoughts are different. 5 minutes doesn't go by without me thinking about my son. And I don't get 5 minutes to myself anymore, unless I sneak off on a wild excursion to Target to buy diapers. Most of my mommy friends feel the same. Motherhood changes you.
I knew motherhood would change me, but to the level that it changed me, absolutely not. This was uncharted territory. I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
It's a whole new level of love and care and concern and anxiety, not to mention fatigue.
I also feel like I am a mom 24/7.
I don't think anybody who's rational would ever have a child because the benefits of having a child are not rational.
But here's another point of view.
Motherhood doesn't have to be transformational.
That's therapist Ann Davidman.
There are people who parent in a very cut-off, unconscious way. I don't know how much transformation they're having.
Davidman runs a 12-week program in Oakland, California called Motherhood, Is It For Me? She says if you're closed off to change, there's no room for personal growth. One of Davidman's jobs is to help people deconstruct their preconceived notions of what they think having a baby will be like.
The process of actually deciding is incredibly transformational if you let it.
Do you have kids?
So I do not have children. I wanted children very badly.
Davidman was married years ago, but her husband was diagnosed with colon cancer early in their marriage.
So we spent the next couple of years trying to get him to live. And after he died, I tried to get pregnant with his sperm.
It didn't work. Still, through her late 40s, Davidman hoped to have a kid. But the right situation never came up. She couldn't afford in vitro fertilization, and she didn't want to be a mother at all costs.
At some point, I made a real decision. I wanted to be a mother, and I'm deciding not to be a mother, and I'm moving in that direction.
When Davidman let go of her desire to have kids, she says doors opened in her life. Romantic relationships took a different path because her ultimate goal was no longer starting a family. She felt complete. And that's when her transformation happened.
I think transformation is something you allow. And you can do anything in your life and either have a transformational experience or not.
Having a baby changes your day to day. There will always be diapers to change and another mouth to feed. But having a kid doesn't necessarily transform who you are. There has to be a readiness for change in order for it to happen. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that report. You know, I'm a father. I have three kids, and kids are wonderful, but they do go through a difficult phase between 2 and 40.
Yeah.
I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about experiences that transform us in deep and fundamental ways. We're joined now by Lori Paul. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's author of Transformative Experience. Lori, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken. It's nice to be here.
Lori, the topic of transformative experiences is kind of original, new to me anyway. It's not one that philosophers have traditionally thought a lot about. So what got you interested in this topic? Did you have some big soul-altering experience in your own life and then start reflecting on it?
Well, that's right. I've been interested in questions about experience and making sense of ourselves as we live our lives and make decisions and plan our futures. I've been interested in that for a long time, ever since I went into philosophy. And before I went to graduate school, I went to India and studied meditation and Buddhist philosophy. And then after I went to graduate school, I got interested in technical work on logic and metaphysics. But I always felt like these questions I had about how to construct a sort of meaningful self-narrative and make sense of reality just wasn't being answered in the way or even addressed in the way that I wanted to. And then I had a baby, and I realized, yes, that the intensity of this experience and the distinctive character of what I was going through could kind of bring all of this sort of abstract theory into focus. So I spent another 10 years really thinking and sort of really tearing my hair out and trying to figure out a way to kind of frame things in a philosophical way for contemporary philosophers, but also in a way that could bring these real life questions sort of into being in a productive way.
So changing diapers and thinking about transformative experiences.
In fact, it was breastfeeding.
Oh, breastfeeding. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a nutshell, to get us started, what do you think? I mean, can we ever rationally decide to undergo a transformative experience, or do we just let them happen and see who we are?
I think if we are approaching a transformative experience or a decision about a transformative experience by thinking that the way to make the decision is by looking within ourselves and seeing who we really are and who we want to become and thinking that we know how we're going to live our future lives after being transformed, then I think, no, we can't make that decision rationally, not on that basis. We have to find a different way.
Okay, so that seems, if you look at it one way, it seems like you're saying, if you look at the experience one way, like as I'm going to rationally decide who I'm going to be in this kind of situation of darkness, I can't do it rationally. But do I hear in your voice the thought that, well, if I look at it a different way, if I reframe the decision, it might be looked at as a rational decision, briefly?
That's right. So I think the ordinary picture is where you think of yourself, you imagine yourself in different future situations, living different futures, as it were, and assigning values to those different futures about what you think, how you think you might want to live your life. If we want to make the decision that way, I don't think we can do it rationally. But my hope is that we could maybe reformulate the decision in a way that isn't going to eliminate the tension between rational decision-making and the way we want to authentically look into ourselves, but we might at least be able to make it as rationally as possible.
Well, we'll have to dig into that. I mean, I'm not quite sure what the thought is, but it sounds like a big, complicated, fascinating thought that might transform my thinking as we dig into it deeper. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about life decisions and experiences that transform us, often in unexpected, even unpredictable ways, with Lori Paul from UNC Chapel Hill.
Have you ever made a decision that forever altered your life, including your very sense of who you are and what mattered to you? If so, how did you decide? Were you surprised by the outcome? In retrospect, would you have still made the same decision?
The rationality of, or irrationality, of decisions that transform us, when Philosophy Talk continues.
It's going
Ah, change is inevitable, at least for David Bowie. But some changes can affect your very core, who you are, what you value. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about experiences that transform us.
Our guest is Lori Paul. She's author of Transformative Experience.
So, Lori, I want to think a little bit about the choice to have a kid, like in our roving philosophical report and your own transformative experience. So I'm not sure that everybody necessarily views the choice to have a kid as this big transformative thing. I mean, it may be this big transformative thing, but I'm not sure that that's how people necessarily view it. Maybe my wife just feels ready for some reason I don't know to have a kid, or my parents are dying to become grandparents, or most of my friends already have kids, and I'm like, maybe I should get with the program. Is there something wrong with letting such considerations be the guiding factor in determining whether I should have a kid or not? Or am I bound to look at it as this big transformation?
I don't think there's, well, it's complicated. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing it that way. But I think it's important not to be, in a sense, I guess, naive about what you're going to undergo. So you might end up having a transformative experience without reflecting on it ahead of time, without rationally deliberating and attempting to do as what decision theorists think of as, you know, maximizing your expected value. Maybe you just do it. But I don't think that that's an especially rational way to approach things. I think that's a way of sticking your head in the sand and avoiding making the decision in any especially deliberative or, I would say, sort of modern way.
So, Lori, we often make decisions that lead to transformative experiences for other people. This is part of having children. I mean, you decide to send them to school. Now, maybe the government decides, but you decide to send a public school or a private school or a Catholic school or some other kind of school. You may decide all kinds of things for your children. If one of your children goes a little bit off the rails, you may make a decision to send them to a military school or a boys' ranch or something that just because it will transform them. So can't the same considerations that go into making decisions rationally for others be used to make decisions rationally for ourselves?
So that's a good question. I think we have to be careful here because the decisions we make for children are partly predicated on the thought that they're not fully formed rational decision makers. I think the thought is that they're not always able to assess the outcomes of their decisions as well as we adults are. And so that's why we're supposed to be a kind of conceptual proxy for them. So there's one kind of question about, well, can't we make decisions about transformative experiences for other people when we don't think they're actually rationally capable? And then there's the other question of, in general, can we make decisions for ourselves about transformative experiences based on what others do?
But I think there's still a puzzle. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, when I decide for my future self that I'm going to have a kid, right? I am now undertaking to have a kid. My future self has to live with the kid. Mm. Now, if my future self regrets what I decided,
Contrary to fact, yeah.
Right? Then, wow, does he get to blame me? That is, there's still, deciding for a kid is in a way like deciding for your future self. You don't know, the kid doesn't know what its values will be, but you don't know what your own values will be. So it's kind of paternalism for you to decide, isn't it? Is that a stretch?
Well, I agree. No. One of the interesting problems, I think, here is you, your current self, you have to make a decision for your future self, and you have to make a decision whether or not to undergo this experience that, let's just assume right now, we know is going to change you. It might not always be the case, but let's say you have good reason to think it's going to change you dramatically and that you don't have any sort of, you know, imaginative access to who that future self is going to be and what they're going to think. So now you have the first problem you have is what gives you the right to make a decision for that future self? And the second question is, I think, whose views matter? Let's say someone could report back to you, you know, at this later time, oh, well, I'm glad you made that decision because I'm very happy with the situation. But they might report back to you and say, why did you do that? I'm really unhappy with the person who I've become.
Right.
I really wish you hadn't done that.
So this is a real, I actually think this is not a made up problem. And I think it's really deep. And it shows up in lots of things. We focused on the case of having a kid, but think a deaf person or autistic people talk this way a lot. Some people think there's a culture of deafness or a culture of autism, and we think, well, we could correct those things. We could give the deaf people cochlear implants. But that would so change their worldview that some people think maybe you shouldn't do that, or some people think maybe you shouldn't cure autism because that's like deciding for them. But so, I don't know. What do you think?
No. Well, I think that's exactly right. I think so. Let me just also going back to making decisions for others. When parents have a profoundly deaf child, they have to make a decision, or they're supposed to make a decision about whether that child should have a cochlear implant very early in life, before the child is 12 months of age, really, because it's going to affect what they decide to do is going to affect the child's cognitive capacities later because of the information, how they're going to, their brains are going to form and what they're going to learn and their learning and their speech abilities in particular. And I think it's an incredibly first of all, it's a hard decision to make for a number of reasons. But if we're expecting those parents to make a decision based on what it's going to be like for their child to live their life, then not only is there a huge amount of pressure, but I think, in fact, we might be asking them to do something that epistemically it's impossible for them to do.
Bill in utilitarianism says that, you know, the only person competent to judge between X and Y is a person where it's a matter of experience and how much happy X and Y will produce is a person who has experienced both. Only a person who has experienced both can be a competent judge. So, you know, I mean, now if Mill's right, you suggest, I mean, Mill's principle would say, well, we can't. I, who don't yet have the child or don't yet have the cochlear implant, I can't be a competent judge of whether I should do this. What do you think about that thought?
Well, I think there's something right about that. That if we're going to make it on the basis of what's the right experience to give the child, so that the child has the right kind of future lived experience, then I'm not sure we can make the judgment at least rationally on that basis. I just want to add one more thing, though. One reason why I think it's important to try to think about these things and recognize at least the possibility that maybe we can't make the decision in this very natural way about, you know, what we're reflecting on, either what we think it's going to be like for the child or, you know, if it's a decision for us, what we think it's going to be like. I think if our future self is not happy with the decision that we made, or if the child in the future wasn't happy with the decision that the parents had made for him or her, I think that it's important to realize that maybe there wasn't any way for them to rationally make a better decision. And that ties, I think, to our notions of blame and tolerance, you know, and empathy and understanding and how people can make what in retrospect are bad decisions, but how they couldn't possibly have been expected to know that they would be bad decisions ahead of time.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about transformative experiences with Lori Paul. We'd love to have you join this conversation, transform this discussion. I think you have an email.
Yeah, we've got an email from Paul, our old friend in San Francisco. Why say that philosophy has not been interested in personal transformation? Historically, I guess I'm the one that said that. Historically, there was much interest. Thrasymachus' blush in book one of Plato's Republic. Aristotle's lost work, the Protreptychus.
Okay.
This is a very educated question.
This is a very educated question.
Augustine's Confessions. I don't know. Maybe because I was stupid.
So is there a big tradition in the history of philosophy, maybe that we contemporary analytic philosophers have lost sight of thinking about these things?
Well, I think that there is. I think there are a number of traditions that have asked questions that are related to this question. And obviously, I mean, even I think in Aristotle's Metaphysics, you'll find a focus on the importance of experience and why we care, and a discussion of how we care about it. But what I'm trying to do is to take contemporary developments, developments, especially in the 20th century, and meld them with these kind of long-standing, deep questions about the role of experience and a sort of general notion of personal transformation. That, I think, hasn't been done. And so a kind of contemporary philosophical perspective on these questions and so-called analytic philosophy, I think, is new.
So it seems to me that one important thing that you believe is that it's experience that matters, right? I mean, you can't make these transformative decisions because you don't in advance have the right experiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
Right.
But I'm not quite sure about this. Suppose I'm deciding, because I can have a lot of views about things I value. I value other people. I value children. I value the children in my community. I recognize that parents value their children in a particular way. I mean, harm a child and see how the parent reacts, and you'll know that parents have a special kind of valuing of their children. I want to have something to value in that way. I don't have to experience having the kid to know that there's a special kind of valuing that I might value. So I'm not quite sure that it's a... You seem to really place the emphasis on the experience. And I'm not quite sure why you want to do that.
Okay, so the reason why I think experience is so important is from basically a thought experiment in philosophy of mind, where we talk about, well, look, what if somebody who had never experienced color before but had all the descriptions from other people about what it was like to see color and knew people valued it and thought it was a really, you know, interesting, important thing to see red and blue and green and see rainbows. What if they had never seen color, but they heard all these descriptions? Would they really know what it was like to see color? And I think, and many people think, absolutely not. That person has to experience color before they know what it's like to see color. They have to experience color before they have the imaginative capacity to imagine themselves looking at a rainbow in its full glory. So I think that, in fact, what we've learned from contemporary philosophical discussions in philosophy of mind is that experience endows us with a special kind of capacity, and it might be that capacity that's key to making some of these rational decisions.
Yeah, but I don't see why that presents a particular problem for these transformative decisions. I mean, suppose that I have been raised in a black and white room, or I have some kind of color deficiency, and there's an operation that can cure it. I think I can rationally make that decision, even though I don't know what it's like to see things. I might be wrong. You know, there are lots of cases of people who were blind that had cataracts removed at a fairly advanced age and got very depressed and wished they hadn't done it. But by and large, I can make the decision rationally. I can look at the statistics. I can look at the fact that people who do have color vision seem to enjoy it very much. What's the special problem about being rational in making the decision?
Well, I think that when we think about these big life-changing decisions, there are a lot of different ways to think about them. But a dominant way of thinking about them involves imagining how you are going to respond to this experience and what it's going to be like for you to live your life, to occupy your future after having the experience. Knowing about statistics or what other people say about what it was like for them, or about how maybe people generally respond to the experience in terms of what they state the results are going to be, oh, I'm happier or I'm sadder or whatever, isn't enough for you to be able to imagine that.
See, I think you're focusing on one thing, but it's not the whole thing. I wouldn't say it's the wrong thing, but it's only one thing among others. When I have a child, say, and undertake or change countries or do have cochlear, there is, sure, I'm going to have a bunch of experiences, and I may not know what those experiences are like. But I don't have a child. I didn't decide to have a child primarily for what I thought the experience of what having a child would be like. I decided to have a child because of this thing I said about valuing a certain kind of life and valuing certain kinds of relationship to people and knowing that having a child would give me something new to value and to value in a distinctive way that is the way in which people value their children. So it wasn't because, oh, I want this experience and this experience. It wasn't about me and my experiences. It was about what it would be like to have a life and value something. So I think you're focusing on one thing and it's in there, but it's not the only thing or even the main thing. That makes it too self-regarding. It's about my experiences.
Okay. So I think it's important. I think experiences are important, but I'm trying to take a kind of a cognitively rich approach to experience where it's bound up with your beliefs and other attitudes. In other words, let's take the case of being a parent. I think that one thing that can happen to people is they think, oh, yeah, I want to be a parent. I want to have, you know, a child and have the kinds of values and experience the kind of life that I see other people experiencing, at least from the outside. But part of the decision involves, do I want to become a parent? Do I want to live my life for the next, as John said, 2 to 40 years or longer in a particular way? And the kind of thing, I guess, that I'm saying is bound up with the experience. So when you have a child, one of the amazing things is many people, if they become deeply attached to their child, as most people do, experience a massive change in preferences. They discover in a unique way what it's like to become less selfish, to be selfless,
right,
almost.
Right. I got that. We've got a caller on the line. Tina, okay, from Bolinas. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. We take your call now. We may answer it after the break, Tina.
Thanks. So I'm hearing conversations about the kind of life events that can be chosen. You know, we'll acknowledge that plenty of kids happen without being chosen at all. And, you know, given that the big picture is living life, trying to pay attention can be a transformative experience, I would really like all of you to talk about the experiences that we don't get to choose, like chronic illness, like life-threatening illness. You know, it seems to me that part of what happens with those is that people are so afraid of death, and of course in this culture we have no way of even talking about that, which you can tell by, you know, there being hardly any vocabulary, and you can always tell what's taboo in a culture and society, but what there's no vocabulary for. And so we have things like chronic illness and life-threatening illness that are way too close to death kinds of stuff for people to be comfortable with, and so people can end up being really isolated. And so to be able to choose for that to be a transformative experience without, you know, sort of the imperative being imposed from the outside.
So Tina, I'm going to cue your question up for Lori to answer after the break. It's a great question, and we'll dig into it after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about experiences that transform us with Lori Paul from the University of North Carolina.
In our final segment, we'll explore some practical philosophical advice for how to make potential life-changing experiences.
Transforming our approaches to transformative experiences when Philosophy Talk continues.
Don't be mad, it's just a brand new kind of me. Can't be bad, I found a brand new kind of free.
You've made a transformative decision. You're a brand new kind of you. Now what? I'm still John Perry. This is still Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm still the same old Ken Taylor. And our guest is Lori Paul, author of Transformative Experiences. And we had Tina's question before the break, Lori. She says, look, some transformative things are just thrown upon you. You got any thought about how we deal with transformations that we don't choose, but that just are thrust upon us? Often awful ones are thrust upon us.
Absolutely. So in the case that Tina was asking about with life-threatening illness, I would say there's still a choice there, and the choice involves how you're going to respond to the situation that you're in. In these kinds of cases, let's say you might have a choice between going into hospice and becoming the kind of person who wants to have a good death and control, like, over her death. Or you might have a choice of undergoing extended treatment, possibly painful treatment and possibly disfiguring treatment in order to try to extend your life. And I think the question there, again, involves your ability to imaginatively assess how your life would be in each possible future. So there's the shorter life that you would live if you went into hospice care, and how you would live your life then and what it would be like for you. And then there's the longer one under the extended treatment.
I don't want to deny Tina's thought, but do these necessarily have to be transformative? That is, can't you make the decisions from your same old value? I mean, if you're not deluded, you know that your life will confront you at times with undesired circumstances as well as desired circumstances. I mean, can I now have a plan that for coping with the onslaught of undesired circumstances such that it doesn't change who I am? I'm coping from my antecedent values and antecedent sense of self.
I think that's possible. I'm not saying that an experience that is transformative for almost everyone must be transformative for everyone. But for this class of experiences, like having a child or finding out that you've got a life-threatening illness and need to make a choice about how to respond to that, for most people, the experience is transformative. And for you, it probably, or at least it's highly likely, that it will be transformative. And you need to face that fact, I think.
So we've got some interesting email here. Here's from Shanti. She says, I'm a mother of two adult children. That was a transformative experience. Hard, changed her focus. But that was not as transformative as her decision in her mid-40s to divorce her husband. Both she and her husband are of Indian origin. They'd been married 23 years, and she married then a Caucasian American. And that is her big transformative experience, is more so than having children. 7 years later, it's still a decision that I constantly question, given I come from a tradition-bound South Indian family. So there's a transformative experience that does involve anything like, having new sensations like a blind person or a deaf person that undergoes the right kind of surgery. But still, could she have predicted what it would be like coming from South India to be married to a Caucasian American?
Well, I do think that empirical work, for example, or statistical data can be relevant when we're making decisions. And that data might tell us, look, you're going to have, or at least suggest to us that you're going to have a transformative experience. And we might get some information about how people are likely to respond, but I don't think it's going to give us the information that when I'm making a transformative experience, I know it's a life-changing decision for me. It's not going to tell me how I'm going to respond. I just know how some people who might be a little bit like me tend to respond. And I don't think that's good enough when I'm talking about something major that's going to change the rest of my life.
Well, then that kind of makes it very hard to gather information. But Rodessa's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rodessa.
Hello. This is a great conversation. I was a teenage mother. At 16, I got pregnant, and my mother and father simply told me that I was going to have the child and that by and by I would understand why, and it was God's will. And now I am 66 years old, and as I'm listening to you all talk, I'm thinking about what would my life have been like if I had not had the child or had the choice to decide to define my own future. And it's just very weighty around my daughter. I feel like she has, my daughter will be 50 in January, and she can be a very morose and dark person. And I want to go and be able to help her transform her life. But I have the sinking suspicion that it has something to do with me being her mother. Because I was so young,
Rodessa, I think you're really raising a deep and important point about these transformative experiences. Because look, when you design or force or whatever to undergo one of these things, what happens? You get a new life, but an old life is closed off. And then you can have two relationships to that old life, Lori. And I'm not quite sure how you're supposed to should weigh these. You can have longing and regret that you let that old life go. Or you can be glad that you let that old life go. Not all choices face you with, like, the constant presence in your mind and in your soul of the path not taken. That makes them really interesting.
I think that's right. I think that transformative experiences are a special class of experiences where, in fact, as you reflect, maybe after undergoing one, about this, I think of this in terms of counterfactuals. What are the other lives or the other paths I could have taken? Sometimes I think what's interesting about them is that they change you psychologically so that you know there's a certain way your life could have gone, but you actually can't even understand it anymore from your present perspective. And I think that's a fact of life.
Yeah, you're focusing on what you can and can't understand. I'm thinking about what do we do about the potential for regret. I know what my life would have been like if I had not had a kid. I would have, I have a kid not knowing what it's going to be like. And then, counterfactually, let's suppose, I have a kid and I am filled with longing for my old life. What do I do about that? I can't undo it. I can't unwind it.
Yeah, I would take some Effexor, maybe.
let me just mention something about what you're saying now. One of the things I think is really interesting about ourselves as agents is that we have a pretty good capacity, actually, when we undergo experiences, to allow those experiences to reform our preferences. So I don't have an answer for when that fails. I mean, apart from John's suggestion about various kinds of pharmaceutical possibilities or counseling, I suppose. But I do think that we should recognize sometimes that, for example, when you choose to have a child, one of the wonderful things is our preferences form as we have that child, to have that very child often.
If you're lucky.
And that we should, if you're lucky. And if not, I don't have any easy answers about what to do, except that we should be tolerant of our decision-making selves.
Now, Laura, in actual practice, many people make decisions not on the basis of their preferences at the time, what they enjoy, what they know, but on some conception of duty, self-realization ethic says you should be all that you can be, or maybe that's the NFL, it's the Marines.
Yeah.
But anyway, it nicely encapsulates, I think, what a lot of us grew up feeling, that you have some obligation to make the best out of the talents and stuff that you were given. Or maybe you have some obligation to do something for your country, even if it's just completely revolting to join the military. Or if you have a gift to serve God, you should do it. Don't those kinds of considerations often trump the kind of things you're worried about, the kind of evidence you're worried we don't have?
I think they can trump it. Part of my point is that we need to understand what we can know and what we can't. My thought is that when we regard these transformative experiences, one approach might be to say, look, I don't know what I'm going to make myself into and how my future life, what my future life will really be like in detail. But maybe I want to discover that. So I want to discover what it's like to become the kind of person who fights for their country, or the kind of person who's a parent, or the kind of person who climbs mountains. I want to become that kind of person. And so I'm going to leap into this transformative experience, not knowing what it's going to make me into and what my future life is going to be like. But that's what the discovery is about.
So, Laurie, this has been a transforming and transfixing conversation. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Real pleasure.
Our guest has been Laurie Paul. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's author of Transformative Experience. So, John, have your thoughts been to any degree transformed here?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, I wish we'd gotten to one question that came in from email, that given that she was studied meditation in India, to get her to talk about her experiences there. So maybe we can have Laurie back sometime to talk about comparing the analytic and more contemplative Indian traditions in philosophy. I tell you, every morning when I wake up, the alarm wakes me up, and I hit the snooze button. And for those 10 minutes, I'm the kind of person who doesn't want to get out of bed. And an hour later, I'll be the kind of person who's glad he got out of bed. But if it was up to me to make the decision, the transformative decision to get out of bed, but it's not up to me. It's up to the snooze alarm, and between the alarm and the snooze alarm, my dog comes and licks my face. So I think it's important. A lot of transformative decisions are made by our parents, or the draft board, or sloth and indifference, or alarm clocks. That's my view.
So you want your transformations not chosen, but thrust upon you for your own good. I didn't know you were such an advocate of paternalism, but this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our webpage at philosophytalk.org.
Since we launched the community, we've had lots of lively discussions with listeners in the community forum. Chats about all sorts of philosophical ideas, great and some not so great.
And from time to time, we like to give our radio audience a taste of what people are talking about in the forum. So John and I will now take up one of those discussions from the community.
Oh, your neighborhood, in your neighborhood.
Ken, today we've got a comment from Eric who writes, all of us eat certain things and not others. The ethical basis of my veganism is my sense of oneness with the universe and compassion for all that lives. I'm not in any way distressed by people eating animals or their products. I'm just interested in their reasons for drawing the lines where they do.
Well, I got to tell you, I've got a non-politically correct view about this kind of thing, John. I'm really moved by the fact that, was it Emerson who said, nature's red in tooth and claw? Animals are food to each other, except for the top predator. They're food to each other. That doesn't cause me any sadness that a hawk eats a mouse, right? That a mouse eats a worm, that a fish eats a minnow. It causes me no sadness. I would really not like it if there were a species that preyed upon humans. I really wouldn't like it at all. But I just can't get bent out of shape about people who, the intrinsic wrongness of eating animals. I just can't get bent out of shape about it. I can get bent out of shape about lots of things surrounding it.
Well, I have a meta worry on this topic. The meta worry goes like this. Suppose there had been radio in the days of Thomas Jefferson and some philosophy talk radio hosts had invited him on to talk about slavery. And one of them had taken the position, maybe in a perfect world there wouldn't be slavery, but this isn't really so bad, so forth and so on. We're just blind to the kind of outrageousness of slavery, which even Jefferson was not. He was hypocritical. But my point is, we would go back and we would pluck that out of the archives and play it, and we would just have nothing but disrespect for this poor slob who took that position. So I now we are on the radio, and given the importance of philosophy talk, the archives will probably last forever. And so I can just imagine people going back and now that you've put the position so clearly, I guess I don't need to, so I don't need to worry them listening about me. Look at this guy, Ken Taylor. I mean, can you imagine being so blind to the absolutely abhorrent awfulness of eating animals as he is?
Now, I do think animals are worthy. Some animals are things of utter beauty. I mean, evolution is a miracle worker. It designs all these living things and puts them all these niches and puts them in this delicate balance, right? And one should have a certain kind of wonder and awe in the face of it and not look at it as a universe of mere things. Right? I don't think humans and animals are like exactly morally continuous, but I wouldn't say that a chimpanzee or an elephant, or a tiger, or a squirrel, or a rat, is a mere thing, like a table is a mere thing, a mere tool. So there's something, I think there is some kind of nuanced attitude that we need to have toward the animal kingdom, that we should treat it with a kind of respect, and we should have a kind of wonder to it. Does it follow that we should treat none of them as food? And I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think so. And again, it causes me no sadness at all that evolution has so arranged things that animals eat one another. So the question would be, what is the incremental moral badness of our doing the eating? Right? If it's not bad that the hawk eats the mouse, why is it worse that we eat the mouse? Right? I don't see why it's worse, unless it's the impact of our eating. It's our practices and all that stuff.
Have you ever eaten a mouse? I mean,
I haven't.
You really have to spice it up a lot.
Thanks, Eric, for your contribution to the dialogue at our Community of Thinkers. You can find out more about our Community of Thinkers and make your contribution by going to our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topete, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online Community of Thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
What's the matter with you?
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.